Welcome to The World According to Boyer, where we bring top investors, best-selling authors, and business leaders to show you the smartest ways to uncover value in the stock market. I am your host, Jonathan Boyer. Today's guest is Caleb Silver, editor-in-chief of Investopedia, a leading business website with over 19 million monthly unique visitors. Caleb started his business news career at Bloomberg, where he worked as a senior television producer. Caleb then joined CNN and was a senior producer for The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer, eventually becoming the director of U.S. Business News at CNN. In 2016, he joined Investopedia. Caleb, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a real honor to be here.
Interestingly, you started your career as a documentary producer, but pivoted to business journalism. What made you switch?
That was an easy pivot. Actually, not at all. I was in journalism school and graduate school at NYU in New York in the mid-90s, but I had started as a documentary producer, and I had just been traveling around Central and South America producing wildlife documentaries. But I wanted to go to graduate school. At NYU, they had an internship program with Bloomberg, and Bloomberg News and Bloomberg TV was really just starting out. I knew how to shoot. I knew how to edit, so I had some TV skills. And I started working for them and interning for Bloomberg right as the internet bubble started forming in the late 90s. As that was happening, I became more and more fascinated with the story of money and the story of business news, and was able to translate my production skills into being an actual TV producer. So when I got out of graduate school, I did some more documentary work, but then I was eventually hired by Bloomberg right as that bubble was forming. So I jumped right into the middle of a big frothy internet bubble.
So what was it like starting at a time where the market, I guess it was 96, 97, was frothy, but if you said to sell the market, you would have been wrong for about 5 years, or 4 years. What was it like being in the media business then?
It was fascinating because it was really the birth of the companies that are some of the giants of today. The Amazon.com was just forming. I got to know Jeff Bezos early on in his days, a CEO as a very new public company. Got to interview him several times. Obviously got to know the companies that rose like rockets and fell like Icarus, like the pets.coms of the world. So I was learning about these internet businesses, learning about e-commerce, learning about this new form of the digital economy while I was covering it. And that was totally fascinating. And at that time, there was a lot of giants and billionaires being born out of startup companies, but also some established companies like Berkshire Hathaway. I got to meet Warren Buffett several times. So I was thrown right into a very busy mix at a very active time. And Bloomberg was trying to cover it in a responsible way because it's a kind of a strict business news media organization, and it was a great place to learn.
When you mentioned you got to meet Bezos, at the time, could you tell that this was a guy who was destined to become one of the greatest entrepreneurs of all time?
Oh, absolutely. And, you could tell just by the way he carried himself and by that raucous laugh that he has. And he would just look at you in that funny way, and you'd ask him a question, he would just laugh in your face. When are you going to make a profit, Jeff? And he would just laugh right in your face and say, we're not interested in that. We're interested in providing the best customer experience on the planet. You just knew he was singularly focused, but you also knew because of the company he carried and the investors that swam in as pilot fish to his whale, you knew that he was going places. And, I was there for the ups and downs of the big internet calls when Blogic called for $500 a share on Amazon, and we interviewed him. All of that was happening at the time, and it was moving so quickly in this new business news television network. It was really a fun place to be.
Do you think the media, I'm just saying as a whole, I'm not saying where you were, but just as a whole, has done right by the individual investor during these ups and downs?
I think there's always room to say that the media could have done better or missed something or were cheerleading, the bad behavior on the way up and making stars out of some of the folks that didn't keep folks' interest in their best interest during the financial crisis. There was a lot of that. Business journalism suffers from access journalism, which means, you want to talk to the power and the powerful. I mentioned Warren Buffett. I mentioned Jeff Bezos. That's cool. They're celebrities in business news. But sometimes we deify business leaders too much, and we don't dig it deep enough when something seems too good to be true. I think it's gotten better, and I think it continues to get better, but there's always going to be times when you look back and say, we should have looked a little bit harder. You could say that about the financial crisis and what was happening in the mortgage industry. You could say it about what's happening now in terms of the uneven recovery and the money going, the stimulus packages and and the rescue packages. You could have said it in the internet bubble as well. We always suffer from that because we get caught up in it like sports, and we don't dig deep enough at times. But at the same time, there's some incredible business news journalism going on right now that will define our medium for generations.
In terms of educating the public, I know they're telling you what's going on, but when I see CNBC, like in March on Sunday night, having special reports, you know, America in crisis, et cetera, is that healthy, or is that something that it's more sensationalism?
There's always going to be sensationalism. And CNBC, which I have a lot of respect for, but they also do treat the markets and investing like a sport, and they're programmed that way, and they've always been that way. So they're, you know, when you have, you know, these massive drops like we experienced throughout March, it's a programming opportunity. Why? Because their ratings are high, you know, while there's a lot of market volatility. And it's no different for Investopedia. You know, we have a lot of traffic. There's a lot of volatility. People are very concerned about their investments and their finances. We benefit from that as well. But they're going to take advantage, TV networks especially, are going to take advantage of the fact that they have a lot of eyeballs on them and make the most of it by dropping in specials like Markets in Turmoil, you know, by keeping up the breaking red bar all day long to make sure people are still glued to it. They're businesses at the end of the day. They're media businesses, but inside those businesses are some very responsible and professional journalists at CNBC, at Fox Business News, at the Wall Street Journal. You know, wherever you look, there are some really good business journalism happening. But of course, they're going to take advantage of the volatility to make a big deal out of it.
So you were an executive producer at The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer. I mean, this was a major show. Can you just take us behind the scenes? You know, what would it be like to work there today during a crisis like this? What would a day be like?
Well, today I still think they're working from home. So everything that we were trying to do, you know, in a newsroom, they're having to do with the challenges of working from home. That said, CNN's doing a pretty good job of it. But I joined The Situation Room right as Hurricane Katrina was forming. In fact, I was down in the Gulf of Mexico the week before doing stories on how to evacuate oil platforms in the event of a hurricane. So Katrina hit right basically when that show started. What that show was basically live feeds from coming from all over the country. And The Situation Room and Wolf Blitzer would present you those live feeds as he was seeing them. So there was almost no delay between what was coming into our newsroom and what was going out on air. And we had to react and pivot very quickly as there was real-time developments happening during Katrina. So there was evacuations, there was flooding, there was the Superdome, you know, there was oil spills, there was nonstop activity. And instead of repackaging, we just gave it to you live. So it was a rush, and you had to be super nimble. And that show was 3 hours. I think it was actually 2 hours, and then it came back for an hour. So we were stuck in our seats covering breaking news basically the entire time.
So now I'd love to talk about your current gig at Investopedia. You know, in full disclosure, I'm a member of the editorial review board at the company, and our research service, Boyer Research, has profiled your parent company, IAC, on numerous occasions. So Investopedia is part of Dotdash, which is owned by IAC. What is Dotdash?
Dotdash, you'll know as About.com from Internet 1.0. So About.com was an enormous reference website, really born in the early days of the Internet. That changed hands a few times. Most recently was with the New York Times when IAC bought it years ago, I think 2014 or 2015. And then right as basically they bought About.com, Google had a big algorithm change, as Google likes to do, and basically pushed a lot of About.com's results way off of the first page. It was a lot of competition, and Google, of course, you know, runs its own search engine and wanted a lot of its results, but it pushed a lot of About.com's results back. And if you know you're not on the first page in a Google search result, you're basically not there. So they tried to rescue About.com. And instead, the CEO, Neil Vogel, and his team realized that the internet was very vertical. People have high intent when they go search for something, unless they're browsing and they're browsing news or browsing other sites. But what About.com had was that high intent traffic. It's not people going into About.com and browsing around. It's people searching something very specific, whether it be a recipe, whether it be a symptoms for a health matter, whether it be information about their finances or about their investments. About.com had all that content, but it was broad and under this one big umbrella. So they broke it into vertical sites, about 7 or 8 vertical sites. So Very Well is the health site, Trip Savvy is the travel site, The Balance is the personal finance site. All of these were About.com/money, About.com/travel. They broke it into these sites, rebranded it, relaunched it, and basically rescued these sites from, you know, the second or third page of Google. Traffic started growing again. And in the meantime, Investopedia was purchased by IAC, I believe, in 2015. in another transaction. We were in a different part of IAC called the publishing unit. But after a while, they realized that Investopedia was very similar to the old about.com sites, to the new .dash sites. And they folded us into that group about 2 years ago. And now we're a part of a portfolio of about 12 or 13 sites, including brides.com, liquor.com. We bought Tree Hugger and the Mother Nature Network recently. Of course, there's Very Well, our health site, TripSavvy, I mentioned. So we are part of a big portfolio that reaches about 100 million people monthly across our sites, but it's all high intent content. It's not stuff you browse, it's stuff you go to for a reason.
I hope you've been enjoying the interview with Caleb. To be sure to never miss another World According to Boyer episode, please follow us on Twitter at Boyer Value. So you mentioned it's interesting. If you're not on the first page of Google, you're basically not there, which is obviously true. And what amazes me about Investopedia is if I wanted to look up a financial term from Google, let's say EBITDA, without fail, you're usually number one or number two. How does that happen?
Well, that's one of the benefits of being 21 years old. So Investopedia is 21. In internet years, John, as you know, that's like 210 years. So we've been around a long time. We've been around with a lot of reference content that has what we call backlinks. So we show up a lot in the first result or first, second, or third result because we have a tremendous amount of content, 30,000 articles on the site. We've been around for a long time, so we have that credibility. We also have a lot of backlinks from influential sites. So it's great to get sites, especially .gov or .edu sites, sites that people respect and are authority, referencing Investopedia's content. So we have that. We have loyal users who rely on us a lot, and we spend, John, a ton of time working and improving our content. You mentioned you're on our editorial review board. We have about 50 people, experts across the entire industry of investing and finance, that review every one of our articles and tell us if it's good or if it needs improvement. We go and improve it, we put it back out, and we're in this constant state of improving and bettering our content for our readers. We want to make sure that we are giving them exactly what they're looking for. And that, plus that legacy and that good reputation, is what helps you get to that first page of Google.
I mean, Ask.com basically almost failed because of Google's actions. You're heavily reliant on Google for traffic. So they're basically frenemies. I mean, how do you protect yourself to make sure that doesn't happen again?
Well, Google updates its algorithm at least two times a year. And in the finance space, as you know, there's two things that are really important to get right on the internet: medical information and financial information. Google has a thing called Your Money, Your Life, YMYL. And they have real human beings who are, you know, smart people reviewing content across our vertical, right? Across the entire finance space. So when they make an algorithm change and they're looking for more authority or they're looking for more expertise from the sites that are providing the information that we're providing, they want to make sure that we have bylines from real authors that actually know what they're talking about, that we have a review board of experts like you and others who actually are professionals in their field and are saying, yes, this is the answer that is the closest to what people are looking for here. This is giving them the information that they need. So they have reviewers that look at that content and they say, yeah, that's it. That's actually what the intent of the searcher, of the reader was. They reward those sites that do better. That's principally how they work, right? There's, of course, sponsored paid advertising you can get on Google. And that's a completely different game, and we don't play that game. We play the make the content as easy and clear and direct to answer users' questions as possible, and we'll get that traffic, and people will come back to us and rely on us year after year after year.
People go to your site or direct to your site to find that information. Pre-COVID, you know, it was a great economy. Unemployment was at record lows. You know, what were people looking to learn more about?
Pre-COVID, we were at record highs. It was record high after record high, but there was some creeping volatility. So we saw a lot of surge in interest around volatility, about what happens when multiples expand, about what happens, you know, what's a market bubble. We also had a lot of people even looking up the other side. You know, what do we do? You know, how do we potentially short the S&P? How do we diversify if we feel like we're a little heavy right now? So it was a lot of the stuff you feel when the market gets a little bit tippy and toppy. You start to get a lot of that search and a lot of that search intent. But don't forget, we had just come out of, you know, 19, which was great, but there was still the phase one of the trade deal that was being implemented. So eyes were on that. There was the 2020 has been a crazy year so far. I believe we had, you know, some attacks on oil fields. There was all kinds of activity happening in the market outside of or pre-COVID.
starting, let's say, in February when COVID became, or late February, early March when COVID was front page news, you know, how have those searches evolved? I mean, today the market is up, I mean, it's March 26th, the market is up big, at least as of a half hour ago. You know, it's been a dramatic rise up. So how has the evolution changed?
Well, we see it in what we call our anxiety index, the Investopedia anxiety index, and that measures search volume around fear-based terms, around the economy, the macro economy, around financial markets, and around personal finance, credit and debt. So there's about 13 or 14 key terms that we look at, but we look at the whole corpus, and we look at that where that search volume is increasing. So as we got into this heavy volatile market in late February, early March, it was obviously around volatility. We were having big, steep market drops. We were having circuit breakers tripped at the stock exchange. So people were looking at that. They were looking at what happens in pre-market trading. They were looking at ways to short the market and hide in gold and hide in fixed income. But then we were also seeing, you know, interest rates, the Federal Reserve enacting this barrage of monetary policy and taking interest rates down to zero. So they started looking about negative interest rates. They were looking at the Fed's impact on the economy, the Fed's impact on the stock market. You could see the anxiety rising, and it was rising even before market volatility got crazy. The anxiety index and the VIX usually track each other fairly closely. And the anxiety index, we found, trips a little bit earlier than the VIX because people are saying to themselves, what's going on? Let me go learn what's going on, coming to Investopedia and other sites to figure out what is happening in the market's dynamics, and then going and executing trades. So it moves kind of in tandem, but a little bit ahead. And then what we've seen since is this great divergence as the markets rallied 28, 30, 32% over the last month or so. The market's done great, but people are very concerned about their personal finances and about the economy, which makes total sense when you see what's happening in unemployment, when you see what's happening in rising bankruptcies, when you see what's happening in these continuing jobless claims. You see this real great divergence between financial markets doing great, but the economy deteriorating under our feet.
So you're basically crowdsourcing over 19 million users a month on how they're feeling.
Right. And that's one of the benefits of being as big as we are. We get our finger sort of on the pulse of what investors are feeling. And these are mostly individual investors that come to us. There are institutional investors that come to us, but they get their research and they kind of know the game like you. But this is, you know, real investors, and they're active. And that we have a couple of newsletters. We have several newsletters. I write two a day, one in the morning called The Express and one in the afternoon called Market Sum. We actually poll and survey our readers because these are very active investors all over the world about what they're feeling, what they're doing with their money, stocks that they're buying, securities or instruments that they're getting in and out of, just to see what they're doing. These are very smart, engaged investors who have a very particular point of view on the markets.
How far back does a index go?
The anxiety index goes back pre-financial crisis, so 12, 13 years. We have data going all the way back that we've been gathering, you know, year after year after year. The surveys we do, you know, we do them every month now because the market's changed so much and investor behavior has really changed. The animal spirits are out in the wild, as you know, John, and it's fascinating to watch.
Well, I guess your wildlife documentary skills will come in handy.
Right. Full circle. I'm back to doing what I started doing.
This seems like very valuable data that you have. It seems pretty forward looking, not backward looking. I'm not a fan of the VIX in terms of, I think it's just too complicated. What you're seeing seems a lot more real. There's a firm data tracker by Nick Colas. I don't know if you know him. And he measures volatility by the number of days the S&P 500 has increased or decreased by 1%. Typical year, I think it's 54 times. I think right now we're on May 26th and it's already happened roughly that 54 times in a year, plus or minus 1%. But this seems like a real measure of what true volatility is.
I totally agree. And I never would have thought of it, you know, beforehand. I was at CNN Money and I helped create the Fear and Money Index, which is, you know, actually looking at money flow through a variety of instruments. And you mentioned your friend with the S&P and it moving 1% or more. That measures, the put-to-call ratio. It measures stocks making 52-week highs or lows. It's got real inputs from the market, but it's very exact in that you can actually get those numbers. The anxiety index is a sentiment index, which is this feeling, you know, of, oh my gosh, what's happening? Let me go learn about this to make sure I understand it in case I need to reallocate, rebalance, put money somewhere. We see a lot of that, and it makes a ton of sense. I came from the news world, as we talked about. The news world is very push, right? Extra, extra, read all about it. Here's what's going on. Let me tell you. The Investopedia world and the Dot Dash world is really a pull world where we're pulling in information by what people are searching for. And it's a very different set of muscles that you use and a very different way of looking at the market and the way investors are behaving. And I find it fascinating.
You know, the anxiety index, you know, speaks to investor behavior. And, you know, I've always loved studying individual investor behavior. And I always feel whether you're wealthy, whether, you know, you're just a regular person on the street, I think the individual investor's worst enemy is usually themselves, their emotions.
Absolutely.
So what are you doing during a time like this to stop that, to help an individual, you know, for lack of a better term, from himself or herself?
Right. Great question. We've had to go into a lot of our content, you know, which was written throughout various market cycles. Don't forget, we're 21. So a lot of the pieces on our site are old. We've got to make sure that we're speaking to people in the voice of what's happening today, because you always have to kind of make sure you're talking to your reader where they are right now. So we've had to update a lot of content. We had a lot of stuff on investing in oil stocks and how to invest in oil stocks. And, you know, when oil collapsed and the entire energy complex basically collapsed under our feet, you know, we had to update a lot of that content and make sure that people realize that this was happening, and a lot of what they were about to read needs to be seen through these lenses right now. So there was a lot of that going on. I also mentioned that we have newsletters. I write a newsletter in the morning and one in the night, always from the point of view of the individual investor, which I am, who is just looking to make sense of the world and then make the right decisions based on where they are in life. And I don't pretend to be an expert stock picker, because I'm not. I don't give investing advice. I give investing perspective. And I work with experts like you even, and others, to give perspective on what's happening. Because the best thing Investopedia can do is educate people about what's happening and help them, lead them to making good decisions, and not tell them what to do, but say, this is the right way to think about these things in order for you to make a call. And then hopefully people will be reasonable or talk to our financial advisor. We're big believers in financial advisors and planners, and then do the right thing. But it starts with education. That's why we've been able to be around 21 years, and why we, you know, we're able to do well in times where people are really seeking to make sense of the world.
And I could be totally off base, but, you know, at least in my opinion, investors in cannabis stocks, investors in cryptocurrencies, for the most part, are going to lose their money. And it's probably puts you in an uncomfortable position, because I imagine that those are pretty high intent driven folks. How do you explain to the average investor how they should be making decisions with regards to, quote unquote, some hot topics? Well, cannabis was hot about a year ago. Crypto is hot, then it's not. Like, how do you do that?
Well, you have to disclose that right away to the reader. We do have a lot of interest in penny stocks, cannabis stocks, crypto, you name it. But, you know, that's been going on forever. Tulip mania, even before tulip mania, there was some other mania. There's always going to be people on the fringe and traders and people that like the action of the market. And look at what we're seeing these days with all the signups on the online brokers and this intense trading activity, and even in the options market, because the market's been hot and volatile, that's brought a lot of new investors in. We start with education, and that is telling people right away, trading in penny stocks, trading in options, trading in and any of these are dangerous instruments. You have to know what you're doing. If you haven't learned, you know, the basics of how to invest in, pick your security, pick your asset class, read this first. And we give them a step-by-step. We even have courses, online courses they can take. And then they want to go and trade. We're not going to stop everybody, but we want to make sure that they know the rules of the road first, because the road can be very bumpy.
And, you know, you talk about the uptick in trading. You know, there's an interesting theory circulating about how day trading is replacing sports betting right now. There's no sports to bet on. Are you seeing any of that? Is there any evidence from your searches, et cetera, that's actually the case?
No, but there is a lot of evidence that there's a lot of first-time investors coming to the market. And we see that through traffic for things like intro to investing or options basics, or how do I invest with $1,000, or how do I choose an online broker to start investing? So we get all of that, right? Plus, we do review the online brokers and the robo-advisors and now Forex brokers to rank them by our experts to tell people which is the best platform for them based on their needs. So we do a lot of that now. So we're getting a ton of traffic there because people are signing up. Good for the industry, but, you know, people are also getting into a risky place. And trading and investing in the stock market's always been risky. But when you have a dynamic like you have today, where the market has been extremely volatile and you've had these intense swings in both directions now, but you have an economy that's crumbling and people's personal finances being upended, it's super dangerous, because what you don't want is for people to take the money that they need to live or pay their bills or take care of their family and try to invest it in the stock market to make a quick buck. That is the easiest way to get burned.
You mentioned that, you know, you have experts rating the best online brokerage firms, et cetera, which I think is a great service to have. But they're also, some of those are your biggest advertisers. So how do you kind of separate church and state there?
Yeah, great question. They are our biggest advertisers. They're our biggest advertisers because our users, our readers, are interested in investing and usually convert and sign up. So they're our biggest advertisers for a reason. But when it comes to product and platform reviews, we are completely editorially focused on that. There is no pay to play. You can't pay to get more stars from us. We review them with our experts who have been doing this for 25 to 30 years, reviewing online broker platforms, completely objective and separated from advertising. And our biggest advertisers are not necessarily our best online brokers in terms of our rankings. And that's proof that we don't favor anybody when it comes to that. So we have to be completely objective. And that's what our readers expect from us. The minute we cross that line, John, whether it's in this or anything, giving stock picks or doing things that are disingenuous to the mission of educating investors, is the minute our business falls apart and everything that we built over the last 21 years falls apart and fades away.
It's rare in someone's career to work for one media mogul. You've had the opportunity to work for two. You know, currently your site's owned by IAC, which is controlled by Barry Diller and his family. You worked at Bloomberg, which was obviously controlled by Michael Bloomberg. They seem to be very different personalities, but I imagine there are some similarities too. Is there a way you can kind of compare and contrast them?
That's a good question. Well, I'll tell you what, I was a very young man in my video production business. When I was 21 or 22, I was at National Association of Broadcasters show. I saw Michael Bloomberg for the first time, never even heard about the man. I'm from New Mexico, so I didn't really know what was happening in the New York finance scene. I saw him speak about the future, and this was about 1993. And he was talking about one day we won't have newspapers, or we might, but what we'll really have is some sort of a tablet where we'll touch things and new pages of the newspaper will come up. And he started talking in those types of terms. And I said to myself, I want to go work for that guy. Like, that man sees around corners. I want to get to know what he knows and his view of the world. And funny enough, I ended up working for him several years later. And he's super intense. When you go to work at Bloomberg, you go into your first day in orientation, everybody had to meet Michael Bloomberg, who had his desk in the middle of the newsroom, in the middle of the TV newsroom, right there with everybody else, no office, sitting out there in the open. You line up to meet him in a parade of about 20 people, and then it's your turn. Michael's working on his Bloomberg, or he's writing something. He looks up at you, and your orientation person says, "Hey, Mike, this is Caleb. He's going to go work as a TV producer for Bloomberg TV. This is his first day." And Mike looks up at you and says, "Don't F it up," and looks down, and then you moved on. Mike was tough like that. Years later, I was covering business news for CNN, and I saw and started reading about Barry Diller and how he had charted this career from the movie business and from USA Networks and into QVC and into Expedia and all these businesses that he created, in this whole notion of businesses that are marketplaces and matchmaking places. Of course, IAC owns Match. And I said, that's a very fascinating person with a really interesting view of the world, running a company that is building the future on these electronic and digital platforms. I want to work for them someday. And, you know, luckily enough, there was an opening at Investopedia at the right time in my career. And I got to do that. I don't have a lot of exposure to Mr. Diller, but I do have a tremendous amount of respect for him and the team that he's built.
Caleb, thank you so much for your time. I really learned a lot, you know, from the state of business journalism to how to get your website to the top of Google. I really encourage our listeners to visit Investopedia. I truly think it's a great site to learn more about investing.
John, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and we appreciate, you know, your partnership and your friendship with the site and the work that you do. So it's an honor to be here, and I really appreciate you inviting me onto the podcast.
To be sure to never miss another episode of The World According to Boyer, please follow us on Twitter @BoyerValue. Until next time.